Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. A couple of guests up tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from David Smick, who is an economic consultant and magazine editor, and author of a new book called The World is Curved, Hidden Dangers to the Global Economy. A book I think he finished in the first phases of the credit crisis. It looks like it was late spring, early summer that he finished it. And here it is coming out in Act 2 or 3 or whatever act we're in, but certainly more intense than it was 6 months ago when he seems to have closed the book off, so we can get an update on the radio from him about the hidden dangers to the global economy, which no longer seem quite so hidden. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll go from the elevated level of the macroeconomy and big finance down to the ground level when we speak with Sarah Ludwig, who is the founder of the National NEDAP, National Economic Development. I'm sorry, I can't remember what it stands for, but we will ask her that. But she will be talking about foreclosure, the state of foreclosure in New York City and nationwide. They are an organization that has been tracking this for a long time, warned that there was a disaster in the making, and now that it's here, we'll find out just what the extent of that disaster is. As regular listeners probably know, this show is broadcast first on WBAI on Thursday evenings, and then it's rebroadcast on KPFA on the following Saturday morning. Since this show has been preempted for most of the last month during WBAI's long, long fundraiser, listeners on the New York area haven't heard a lot of my comments on the current financial crisis. So apologies to the KPFA audience and those of you hearing this on the web or by podcast if this repeats any of the material you've been listening to over the last few weeks. But it seemed important to update the hometown listeners on what this all means. Many times over the last years, I've invoked the old Timex watch slogan from the 1950s, takes a lickin' and keeps on tickin', to describe the U.S. economy. Crash follows upon panic upon bust, and yet the thing keeps getting up to binge some more. The remarkable feats of revival, though, has usually come with a big help from the U.S. government, either in the form of multi-billion dollar bailouts, or more prosaically, a long round of indulgent monetary policies from the Federal Reserve. But revive it did, time and again, despite the forecasts from the hard left and the hard right that this time it was different and the medicine just wouldn't work one more time. So here we are again. Before the House's no vote on the bailout, there was reason to believe that the U.S. economy's luck had run out. That doesn't mean that it was straight to a rerun of the 1930s, but it did mean that we were likely to face years of very sucky economy. And for a while, when it looked like that bailout package might not materialize, it was looking kind of scary. But now we got a bailout and a lot more. It was extraordinary, though, and probably not surprising to see many on the so-called left having called for a no vote on that bailout and then cheering its initial failure. Some hyper-radicals even called for the whole system to come smashing down. Well, that's not politics. That's nihilism. There are many things wrong with the proposal, especially in its initial pure Hank Paulson form. Congress did improve it some, but it was still flawed. More on all that in a bit. But there's no escaping the fact that if the federal government doesn't spend some serious money to revive the banking system, we would be facing a very severe recession. We're in a recession already, but it's a mild one so far. But should the credit system implode, despite all the money that the feds are throwing at it, things could get very deeply nasty. There's not much need to review how we got to this sorry pass. I've been talking about that for many, many weeks and many months of explaining what gave rise to the current financial crisis. But people borrowed huge gobs of money to buy houses they couldn't afford and then borrowed more gobs of money against the rising value of those houses and spent it all on lawn furniture and widescreen TVs. Almost a third of the growth in consumption between 2001 and 2007 was financed with so-called home equity withdrawals. And of course, Wall Street, which can never let well enough alone, enabled all this mad borrowing and also complicated it with a raft of synthetic securities that hid many of the risks from people who nonetheless should have known better, professional money managers who bought all the wacky derivatives that have since blown up. These last couple of paragraphs are intended not just for their analytical scene setting, but to make an essential economic point. Some progressive pundits and politicians have argued that any government bailout should be aimed at debtors, not banks. Underwater mortgages, not toxic collateralized debt obligations. It would be nice if we had that choice. But sadly, the finest minds of Wall Street added to all those underwater mortgages layer upon layer of opaque and leveraged structures that are now sources of major mischief in themselves. That means that any possible rescue or bailout, take your choice of words, has to attack both parts of the problem. Since the history of financial crises shows that the speed of response is crucial, And since it will take a long time to sift through several million upside-down mortgages, about one in six, according to the latest estimates, the wobbly financial superstructure will have to take precedence in time, but not importance. Support for the urgency of a quick response comes from a very useful review by two IMF economists, Luc Leban and Fabian Valencia. Their work isn't standard-issue IMF ideology, but a historical database of banking crises around the world since 1970, all 124 of them by their count, and they take a closer look at 42 of them. They take a measure of what was done to resolve these crises and how much they cost. That speed matters is obvious to anyone who followed Japan's dithering in the 1990s. Standing aside and hoping the problem goes away is not a good idea. Paulson's original do-it-now schedule was way too accelerated, but waiting for months could have been very damaging. Levon and Valencia show that some sort of systemic restructuring is a key component of almost every banking crisis. That means forced closures, mergers, and nationalizations. That's already well underway in the U.S. Shareholders frequently lose money in any systemic restructuring, often lots of it, and are often forced to inject fresh capital. We've also seen some of that, and we're going to see some more. The creation of management companies to buy up and essentially sell distressed assets on behalf of the government, either financial assets like loans or real ones like strip malls or housing tracts, is a frequent feature of banking crises and their responses, and are central to Paulson's plans, but these do not appear to be terribly successful. More successful are recapitalizations using public money, meaning that the government injects funds into the banks in exchange for stock. Such stock is usually sold off, quite often at a profit, when the banks return to health. Though, of course, a government with socialization on its mind could just keep it. Though such recapitalizations weren't a part of Paulson's original plan, it's now looking like they're going to happen. And Levon and Valencia often find that relief for troubled debtors. And Levon and Valencia often find that relief for troubled debtors, reducing either the principal or interest on their loans or both, often helps get an economy get out of a financial mess. This is a nice coincidence of economic efficiency and social justice. These bailouts are not cheap. Based on the experience of other countries, our bill should reach several hundred billion dollars. Sweden's approach is often taken as a model. That country experienced a mad credit and real estate boom in the late 1980s after its previously tightly regulated financial system was deregulated. The bubble burst in 1991, and the government stepped quickly in to support the banks. The initial outlay amounted to 3.6% of GDP, which would translate into about $500 or $600 billion for the U.S. But as the banks returned to health, the Swedish government sold its shares, recouping almost 95% of its initial outlays. It's not like we'll be that lucky, but you never know. Those who don't want to spend that kind of taxpayer money should consider this. Levon and Valencia, the IMF economists, find that there appears to be a negative correlation between output losses and fiscal costs. In other words, what you save on expenditures, you more than lose in a deeper recession. It was good to see that the House of Representatives improved upon Treasury Secretary Paulson's original proposal, all 840 words of it, the length of a typical newspaper column. Paulson originally proposed to give himself total discretion over the expenditure of $700 billion without even the potential for judicial review. Even if Congress was motivated by an insult to its institutional narcissism rather than principle, this was certainly too much to ask. So they added an oversight board, limits on executive pay, and some protection for homeowners, although we'll see how much teeth these provisions have. But then the House initially rejected their own improved product. Most of the opposition came from the Republican right, though some of the more leftish Democrats helped out. Republican complaints were delusional. One of the leaders of the right flank of the anti-bailout camp said the rescue plan would lead the U.S. down the road to socialism. If only. Capitalism, even in its allegedly purified neoliberal form, has always depended upon the state for its introduction and maintenance. Markets aren't natural. They're imposed and sustained by political power. But if the right opposition was delusional, the left opposition flirted with the juvenile. We heard many times during the days leading up to the vote that we shouldn't be handing money to Wall Street. Instead, we should be spending it on schools and green jobs. Yes, it would be lovely to spend lots of money on schools and green jobs, and I certainly want to do those things. But presenting this as an either-or thing raises some problems. One is that these are long-term investments. They won't do anything to ease the immediate financial crunch. And another problem is that there aren't the votes in Congress or the support in the broader population for that kind of spending program. That's tragic, but true. Don't the people calling for such things realize that? And speaking of the politics of the rescue, all the claims they've heard about the new populist resistance to the big boys of Wall Street, all that's at least best a partial truth. Most polls show the public realizes that some sort of bailout package is necessary and fear that doing nothing would only make things worse. Opinions are murky and contradictory on these issues, which isn't a surprise given the size and complexity of the problem. But those who claim to speak for the people should check out what the people actually think. A number of progressive no proponents even deny that there is any real financial crisis. They argue that it's a hoax, a shakedown, to transfer a few hundred billion dollars from taxpayers to bankers. It will be helpful if some of these people actually knew anything about finance or economics, but the closest thing to evidence that some of them offered was a citation of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. If you think it's a hoax, it does relieve you of the responsibility for suggesting what to do about the problem, since it's no longer a problem. How convenient. There's a lot to admire about the work of Naomi Klein, but her book is rather badly flawed. It's a one-size-fits-all version of history that's not really up to the task. It treats centuries-old features of capitalism as innovations. It totally ignores the fact that neoliberal regimes, many of them run by center-left parties, have repeatedly won elections in the U.S., Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and India. For a more detailed critique, see the review on my website at leftbusinessobserver.com. It's one thing to misread history. It's another to use that misreading to misread the present. This crisis is real. The credit markets are imploding. And even some people who should know better, like the normally sensible Dean Baker, have been saying some odd things. Last week, Baker denied that there's any credit crisis because interest rates are low. But the credit crisis isn't about the price of credit, but its availability, whether or not you can get a loan. In a lot of places, you can't. Banks have virtually ceased to lend to each other. Baker also cited allegedly low interest rates on mortgage loans, but since such lending has virtually ceased, the interest rates are purely notional. Ditto mortgages. He cited low interest rates on those, but those too are very difficult to get unless you've got a high credit score and a big down payment. The commercial paper market, a major source of short-term funds for large banks and corporations, has contracted dramatically. And most signs are that these problems are getting worse, not better. If this continues, it's only a matter of time before banks cut back further than they already have on the day-to-day business loans that keep the whole economy running. Without those loans that allow companies to buy inventory and raw materials, the economy will grind to a halt. But given the importance of a bailout and the unity of a ruling class and the urgency of its passage, the House did reconsider after the bill was reworked and passed by the Senate. But there are many ways in which to improve upon even the modified Paulson plan. It's probably better than nothing, but it's got a lot of problems. So let me say a few words about what might make a better one, first in the realistic sense, fully aware of the constraints of American politics, and then in the more fanciful sense of what we might do in a better world. With the bailout now law, it's too late to modify it for now. But it could be revised, with a new Congress and a new administration in power next year. Though it looks like the Paulson plan will use considerable discretion that the bill allows them, it looks like he will, among other things, do some bank capital injections. As I said earlier, this has proven to be much more effective than just buying up bad assets. And Paulson has surrounded himself with some former Goldman Sachs cronies. He and they must be carefully scrutinized so that they don't steer several scores of billions of dollars towards their former employer. And relief for troubled debtors must be put at the center of the plan and not relegated to a possibly fortunate byproduct or afterthought. The banks must take a hit on those bad loans, unlike John McCain's proposal, which would have the government pick up the full tab for losses and leave the banks untouched. Waxing more utopian, finance must be re-regulated. It's reasonable that that wasn't considered in the first cut at the bailout. Figuring out how to regulate this massively complicated financial system is no easy matter. But it's got to be done. You can take that further and say that banking is rather like an old-style utility, something so essential to all of us that it should be regulated like electricity used to be before the preposterous experiment with utility deregulation. And if the government is bailing out and nationalizing banks and other financial intermediaries, why not keep some of them in the public sector? Why not use them to fund real economic development and neighborhoods starved for capital? Why not extend low-cost financial services to poor people who are now fleeced by check-cashing services and payday lenders? Yeah, this is American capitalism where we only socialize losses and never gains, but we can dream, can't we? Okay, let's take a little musical break.
I'm standing on the stage. I'm working in a restaurant. I make a decent wage. And I will sing into the microphone. The river school and shops, how far?
little bit of The River from the new album by David Byrne and Brian Eno, and a very nice one it is. And now we're joined by David Smick, an economic consultant based in Washington and author of the book The World is Curved, Hidden Dangers to the Global Economy. They're not quite so hidden anymore, are they, David Smith?
No, they were looming just over the horizon. We couldn't see them, and I wrote my book to point them out. And now we can see them.
Yeah, it looked like, just from judging from the text, it looked like you finished it up maybe in late spring. When Act One of this multi-act drama was, it looked like things might have been stabilizing a little bit, but now.
Right, I started it before the subprime crisis hit. I was at a dinner party in Washington and spouting off about it. I said, even though the financial system looks great, there are these hidden, you know, fault lines, cancers in there that, and we should get ready for a real problem. Driving home, my wife said, you should write about this and make it simple so everybody can understand it. So that's what I did.
And actually, the closing line of the book is, a second Great Depression seems unlikely, but the thought is no longer a complete absurdity.
Well, it's funny, I put that in, and I was, you know, some of the people who looked at the draft said, isn't that a little extreme? I said, no. I said, I passionately believe that we need this book is a call to arms to wake up. I mean, I found your commentary very interesting. You know, you have, you mentioned two groups. You have the people who say there's no credit crisis, and then, of course, they have the officials in Washington who passed the bailout package. But I think turns out the credit crisis is more serious than even they thought. I mean, I think, you know, I think we needed to do something, but I was a little concerned that the package was being presented as some magic elixir that was, you know, if we swallow or magic pill, if we swallow the pill of the bailout, everything would go away. And I think it, you know, the bailout just keeps us from a catastrophic situation. It's kind of a firewall, but this is a very serious situation right now.
Well, there's the $700 billion bailout, none of that money, of course, has been spent yet, but it's going to be spent shortly. And it looks like Paulson is going to use his discretion to even inject capital into the banks, which was not an issue at first. But there are also many other ingredients. The Fed and the other central banks are throwing huge amounts of money at this problem. The Fed is buying up assets that we never could dream that the Fed would be buying.
Right. I talked to somebody at the Fed today, and they said, pretty high up, and they said, you know, we had these tools in our toolbox, like the ability to buy up assets, you know, regardless of the collateral almost. And we thought, well, they're the tools we'll never use. And here we are using them, and the market's still getting clobbered.
Well, they're inventing and manufacturing new tools on the run, too.
Yeah, I credit them for that. You know, this is no time for ideology. It's time to be pragmatic. Whatever works, works. Do whatever you have to do with an eye toward working people.
Well, it's also a good idea that it's a good thing that we have a guy at the helm, Ben Bernanke, who studied the Depression and really knows what causes them.
So. I agree with you 100%. I mean, you want a guy who knows who knows sometimes what you don't know. You don't want a guy who's reckless and thinks he knows everything.
Well,
rewriting history every day.
Well, I'm going to say it's better him than his predecessor, who made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, I think the books are being written. It's unfortunate for him.
Given what they've thrown at it, given the passage of this legislation, given what the Treasury, the Fed, and all the other central banks, and even other governments, the British government injecting huge amounts of capital into its banking system. The credit system is still pretty frozen.
Well, I think
is this
that's what's so interesting right now. It's so frightening. I mean, if you look at the U.S. system right now, the problem is no longer liquidity. I mean, the Fed has, as you so aptly pointed out, it's got all these liquidity facilities. I mean, Ben Bernanke's being very pragmatic. They're buying assets. They're doing it's kind of like throw the kitchen sink at the problem because you may not have another chance. And I think that's been good. And they've come up with the $700 billion package, and they've left themselves a lot of flexibility with how they can use it. So there is liquidity. The problem is the banks lack the confidence to lend. I mean, it's a huge problem of distrust globally. Bankers don't trust each other. The central banks don't trust the banks. I mean, it's a problem of a crisis of confidence.
So, is it going to become? Are they going to be able to thaw the credit system?
Well, you know, it's funny. You make a you made a point about the interbank market, and the average person says the what, and you tell them, oh, that's the market that, you know, where banks lend to each other and it's, you know, money moves back and forth. And it sounds like a very tedious point that you don't want to talk about. But it's actually, you know, it's like if you went into the American Financial House, you saw this huge pipe, you know, in the basement running down the length of the house. You say, what's that? Well, that's the interbank market. And, of course, if that pipe, part of the plumbing, just, you know, seizes up, you know, it's pretty bad for the house. And I think that's, you know, that's what's happening now. I frankly think that they don't have a lot of time to fix that, and they have to do it globally. I mean, they could have a government guarantee of those of that interbank market. I guess my proposal, and I've passed this around at the Fed and the Treasury because I'm based in Washington, is I think they need to have a new kind of public-private global clearing facility for the banks. Right now, there's in banking they call it there's no counterparty risk. There's used to have the Lehman Brothers and the other financial institutions would be on the other side of passing the, you know, capital back and forth. Now there's no one on the other side willing to take the risk. So you have to have then created some type of an institution that will perform that role. And you say, why public and combined with private? I don't think you can trust the banks just to do it themselves. These guys are too greedy. I think if you trust the regulators, they lack the sophistication. I mean, a poor guy working as a GS-14 at the SEC is no match for these Wall Street guys making millions, and their lawyers make millions, and they can come up with all kinds of clever means around them. So you really have to bring these guys together in an institutional effort to say, and you know, the central banks would put up capital and the banks would put up capital, but you would have at least essentially a fund that would operate that interbank market and free up the system. But you know, it's time to think that they've got to clear that quickly.
I'm speaking with David Smick, who is an economic consultant based in Washington and author of the new book, The World is Curved, Hidden Dangers, or not so hidden dangers to the global economy.
Which, by the way, Bill Clinton just endorsed as one of his three picks for books on the current global credit crisis.
So, you know, time is running short, but how did we get to this sorry pass?
Well, it's funny. I think without going into a whole lot of detail, the average person's, they hear, it's a bunch of, you know, banks were pressured into lending to a bunch of poor people to buy houses, and the houses defaulted, and that's the kind of a conventional view. And I think
that's a particularly Republican view, isn't it?
Yeah, I just think it's a gross oversimplification. The banks about 10 years ago and the investment banks changed their operation of doing business. Instead of, say, as me as the lender lending you a mortgage, and you and I know each other for 30 years and you pay the mortgage back, the interest payments to me and pay off your mortgage, you know, I as the banker under this new system decided to kind of put all the mortgages I had together in on the table, and I diced and sliced them up into little pieces and mixed them together like a giant, beautiful salad. And then the idea was the banks would sell, for a fee, little bowls of salad all over the world. They call those asset-backed or mortgage-backed securities. When you hear that phrase, they're selling little bowls of salad. The problem is, every once in a while in this big, beautiful salad, there'd be a piece of lettuce, and under that piece would be a bit of toxic waste. And a subprime, defaulting subprime mortgage. And so, but you didn't know where you knew if you ate one of those pieces, you'd die, but you didn't know where it was. And suddenly the whole global investment community said, we're not buying any of that salad anymore. And that left the banks, you know, with this huge problem, salad coming out of their ears. So what we face now is a fundamental crisis in our architecture, the way the banks do business. I mean, having some poor people write off, default on some mortgages because interest rates run up, you would have had maybe a 6 or 8 week period of turbulence in the markets, but you know, you're not going to have the worst financial crisis since the 30s. This is something much more fundamental, and that's why I think our policymakers have really failed us. They're driving the policy vehicle looking through the rearview mirror all the time. They need to look ahead and say, what is the actual real problem? one of my problems with the Treasury plan was, you know, Paulson said, you know, bailout now, reforms later. And I would love to see the reforms. Of course, the reforms are, you know, going to be tough on some of the banks, but they need to have the reforms in place to say why this won't happen again. If they did that, believe it or not, there's a lot of, you know, the problem is not that there isn't money in the world. The money is all on the sidelines. It's sitting in money market funds and other entities, you know, waiting for this thing to blow over. If you reform, the faster you reform the system, the more the money will move back in. It's kind of the Willie Sutton approach. You go where the money is, but you have to reform this system. I mean, you can't have a system where even the specialists during a time of crisis, they don't have a clue of what any of these instruments mean. They look at their balance sheets at the banks and they say, beats us. We don't know what this stuff means.
Well, to extend your metaphor of earlier, if we have all these bowls of salad, maybe one out of every 10 or 20 has the piece of toxic waste in it, and maybe the other, you know, the other 18 or 19 or whatever are actually edible. So if we could clarify which are the toxic, which ones
right.
contain the toxic waste, we could get the system flowing again.
Well,
is that possible to do that in a reasonable amount of time?
Right, and in the future, if you said if you're going to sell salad, you got to have a label on it. The label said who made the salad, what's in the salad, but also if you lie about the label, you have huge liabilities. You can't fudge this stuff, and we didn't have that. We had a bunch of bankers who we trusted, and they didn't come through. So I think there needs to be serious reforms. The other thing is this clearly has to be a global solution because. If you come up with an American solution, I can just tell you Wall Street is too clever about what they call arbitraging the differences between countries' regulatory systems. The world has to hang together in defining the new, you know, kind of the new rules of the road for the banks. And it's got to be together. And a bailout concept, I mean, you know, if a big European bank collapsed tomorrow, I can tell you that American workers would be affected. And same thing if an American bank collapsed.
Yeah.
This notion that Europe is separate is nonsense.
Now, we're running on time, but there are two topics I do want to cover. One is, how bad do you think the real world fallout is going to be? Right now, it's mostly a financial problem. The real economy is troubled, but it's not disastrously so. Will that continue, or is it really going to get nasty?
Well, you know, it hits Main Street with a lag time. Usually always hits. And I think it's going to be a very rough 2009 for this reason. The problem is going to be, not enough money to lend and tough conditions. I mean, the bankers, frankly, I mean, it's one of the things we haven't really, you know, I say policymakers are looking in the rearview mirror. I mean, even if we, tomorrow, if Paulson said, look, here's what I've done. I worked all night. I've cleaned off all the bank balance sheets. What is that? How do we then get the banks to lend? These guys are scared rabbits. They all want to, you know, they're hiding. They're like they're hiding under the bed. They all think they're going to be indicted. Maybe they should, but they're definitely, you know, we're in a situation where we're looking at a potential serious credit crunch. I mean, the banks, just look at the numbers. The banks have $2 trillion less to invest than they did a year and a half ago. Now, banks generally are leveraged institutions. That is, they borrow on their assets by about 10 to 1. Just by contrast, you know, Bear Stearns was 34 to 1. Fannie and Freddie are about 75 to 1. So banks are around 10 to 1 leverage. What that means is if they lost $2 trillion, that means next year we're going to have about $20 trillion less in credit availability than we had a year and a half ago. And that's going to be tougher on small businesses. I mean, they'll lend to Warren Buffett, but he's the only guy who doesn't need the money. You know, it's entrepreneurial risk.
He's lending it out.
Who's taking on risk that may, you know, that I worry is going to face the problem here.
And then the other question is, you said this has to be an international effort, and you're of course right because this is an international financial system, and money flows all over the place in an instant, but. We have in the past, it's been very difficult to do anything internationally without the United States taking the lead. Now, the United States is not liked in the rest of the world because we already had a problem with George Bush, and now we've poisoned the world's financial system with our subprime and credit crisis, and so the rest of the world is mad at us. Are we going to be able to accomplish anything with that kind of weakening of American power?
Well, you make a good point about all that. I guess I would say, if you look at the European attitude, a lot of people in the who are coming into this G7 meeting this weekend are talking about the lost 3 weeks or the three lost weeks for Europe. You know, Paulson announced his plan. We just, you know, for the last 3 weeks of all this, uproar in the U.S., the Europeans have acted like smug, like they don't have a problem, and like poor Americans. And you don't call us, we'll call you. Well, lo and behold, it turns out the Europeans have more exposure to this toxic waste than even the American firms. And what's interesting about Europe is that for many of these countries, particularly the smaller countries, and if you throw in the UK, the exposure of their financial institutions is a multiple, sometimes four and five times GDP. In my book, The World is Curved, I point out how a year ago, the head of the Swiss Central Bank told me with some look of shock on his face, he said that they looked at one of their banks, a bank called UBS, its financial exposure was four times the size of Switzerland's GDP. In other words, they couldn't bail out that bank even if they wanted to. And I think Europe's problem is that, you know, with this situation is they can have the government say, hey, we guarantee all loans. But what does that mean if it's like going into a gambling casino and saying, you know, I have a $100 bill and say, I guarantee everybody at this poker table, but the stakes are $500. And people say, well, that's a nice guarantee, but you don't have the money to back up that charge. And so I think there is a possibility, I wouldn't say it's more than 30%, that the European financial system has to be nationalized. And the same with, I think Britain is already moving in that direction. This is an earthquake that's going on in the global economy. And I think, if the Europeans wasted 3 weeks where they should have been developing a strategy and working with everybody else in the globe. And I'll say one other thing that, again, policymakers look through the rearview mirror. They never look ahead. We ought to be looking very closely at China, and we ought to be working with the Chinese because if they start to pull capital at this sensitive time because they feel pressure at home to buy off domestic constituents because their economy is weakening fast and their exports, which they're dependent on, a lot of them to us are weakening. I mean, that could be like throwing kerosene on a huge fire. So this is a global system that hopefully the next president of the United States doesn't wait around till, March, but starts thinking about this, the first day after the election and starts working with a transition team to try to develop the international connections to try to manage this problem.
And China, too, has some pretty rickety financial institutions, though.
Oh, my God. It's like you talk about they make ours look pure and clean. I mean, these are state-run outfits of enormous corruption, but I'm worried just about, it's not like a Chinese government would go out of its way to do something foolish, but people do stupid things, and they say, well, we're under pressure. We have to maintain our power base. We have to either we sell into the market, dump things, or we become a deflationary force, which would be dangerous for the world, or they panic and they start pulling capital and suddenly our long-term interest rates go up further, and that's the problem. There's one troubling thing about what unfolded today. You saw the stock market got clobbered again, went down by a huge margin. But I noticed long bonds, which would usually rally because people would say, well, that's a reflection of a weakening economy. The long bonds actually deteriorated, which means that the value, that the market's saying with that the the Fed is taking on so much debt that they're now, such demand for those bonds that we're not seeing necessarily a lowering of long-term interest rates.
Well, if there's a lot of demand for those bonds, there's going to be plentiful supply in the coming months too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us with all this grim news, David Smith.
I know. I hate to ruin the weekend, but on the other hand, it's we are the first to go into this mess in the world and we'll be the first to come out, which is at least the silver lining.
Well, let's hope so. And at least UBS has Phil Graham to help them out.
That's right.
All right. I've been speaking with David Smick, who is the author of the book, The World is Curved, Hidden Dangers to the Global Economy, How the Mortgage Crisis Was Only the Beginning. And, boy, truer words were never spoke. That book from Portfolio, imprint of Penguin. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. All right, I'll be back after a little musical break.
The dimming of the light makes the picture clearer. It's just an old fall down.
And then another song from the new David Byrne and Brian Eno album, that one whose name now escapes me, I'm sorry to say. It's called, but that song called Home, and it's nice to hear from the two of them again, and not doing a lot of that pretentious art crap, but just good songs. And now we're joined in the studio by Sarah Ludwig, who is the director and founder of NEDAP, and then I'm going to ask her to remind me of what NEDAP stands for.
NEDAP stands for the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project.
Okay, and... You, of course, have been following the subprime and foreclosure crisis in New York for quite some time. You and your colleagues were well ahead of everyone else in warning of what was going on. And now here we are in the depths of it. It's not just a crisis for people who are having their homes taken away, but also a global financial crisis now. And first, I did want to get an update of what's going on with those folks, but you said you wanted to pick up on some of the things that David Smick was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, he was using a sort of salad metaphor to talk about these bundles of loans that were securitized on Wall Street that helped drive the crisis that we're now in, as lenders made high volumes of loans and really found the money, the profits, was not in the making of loans to borrowers, but in the selling those loans off on as in interests or securities on Wall Street. And, you know, to bring it to New York and to cities really across the country, you know, we can use the salad metaphor and say under the lettuce there was toxic waste, but it wasn't randomly distributed, because the engine that drove this lending through Wall Street really kind of pushed out into neighborhoods these toxic products. And we see very distinct, very disturbing patterns as to who got these toxic loans. And there's a very strong correlation between the very abusive lending practices, the high-cost loans, and the really toxic products that went out to people of color and neighborhoods of color in the city. It's a pattern that repeats itself all across the country. And so, yes, you don't just have families who are grieved by the reckless lending that went on, but you have entire communities of color where there are overwhelmingly disproportionate concentrations of the foreclosures and the high-cost loans.
Yeah, now, to use the language of econometrics, this is it's not just a matter of income. It's really about race. Because, if you hold income constant, race would be a significant variable nonetheless, right?
Yeah, and I think that's really important. So I know there are listeners in California and in New York, but for New Yorkers especially, you know, you can go on our website, which is NEDAP.org, and there are maps that show that neighborhoods of Southeast Queens, which are predominantly Black communities that are middle and upper income neighborhoods, are as hard hit by the subprime loans and the foreclosures as anywhere you're going to find in the country, really, because you have a lot of homeownership, and it's definitely a matter of race, not income. And that's a good control example if you want to look at neighborhoods in the city where this is the case. But this is not new information. I mean, HUD itself put out reports looking at data in 2000, looking at 1 million mortgage records from around the country, and found that there was a direct correlation between race, and you had a higher likelihood of getting a subprime mortgage back then, as 8 years ago already, if you were an upper-income Black borrower than if you were a low-income white borrower. So this is information that regulators knew. This is information that advocates knew. Certainly people living in neighborhoods where this was, you know, hitting really hard for really the last 10 years knew this was happening.
What's behind this? I mean, we could say racism, but, you know, obviously that's what it is in some sense. But, you know, as they say in academia, unpack that for us.
All right, I'll try to unpack it because there's a lot to unpack. But in a nutshell, what you've got are sort of these historic patterns of exploitation of communities. And these same neighborhoods where you see the big sort of concentrations of foreclosures right now, communities of color, are neighborhoods that have been historically redlined, where people were cut off from access to conventional forms of mortgages and other kinds of credit. And what happened, you know, really in the 90s is that because of deregulation, because of the boom in the real estate market here in New York and some other factors and the sort of emergence of the subprime industry, you had the same neighborhoods where there had been real credit vacuums flooded with high-cost credit. People who had built up a lot of equity in their homes, many longtime homeowners who were getting older, who'd raised their families in these homes but had bought them relatively cheaply, were now sitting on homes in neighborhoods in central Brooklyn, in southeast Queens, in the North Bronx. They're worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. So this whole mortgage crisis really began.
Was this a byproduct of gentrification then, in some sense?
I think that there's definitely an element about that. And you have certainly equity that people at the beginning of this crisis in the 90s or the beginning of the kind of proliferation of high-cost abusive loans were really going after this equity to strip it out of community. So the different lending practices and different products that have brought us to where we are really just a layering of ways to really extract wealth from these communities. And it's not subtle. So, you know, one could talk about the fact that certainly there are many white borrowers who got subprime loans in this country, but some of the most noxious products that you're going to see were sold to, already existing homeowners. There's a big myth out there that somehow the subprime lending boom, yes, it had its problems, but it led to a lot of homeownership opportunity for many people who otherwise wouldn't have become homeowners. You talked about that a little bit earlier with your previous guest, which is this notion that the push towards homeownership and, you know, getting people into homes and getting mortgages was part of what caused banks to make these bad loans. But the fact of the matter is that most of the loans going into foreclosure, even now, are refinancing loans or to people who already had a mortgage to pay off that initial one. So, and there's definite targeting there.
But the Clinton administration did encourage like 0 to 5% down homeownership schemes as almost a substitute for public housing. It was some sort of market-friendly housing program, didn't it?
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with that. I know there were definitely a lot of rhetoric around that and encouragement, but when people talk about laws like the Community Reinvestment Act or as being, you know, sort of the reason that we have this global financial crisis now, these are people who know that they're not telling the truth, because what they're trying to suggest in a sort of thinly veiled way is that these loans made to Black and Latino borrowers is what's causing all of this. I mean, that's really, if you cut right through what they're really saying. Again, these were mostly refinancing mortgages, not home purchase mortgages. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that most of the mortgages that are subprime, that have, we'll call them toxic mortgages or problematic mortgages, were not made by banks that were subject to the Community Reinvestment Act. And let me clarify that because it's important. They might have been made by affiliates of banks, subsidiaries of banks, but they weren't the part of banks that were subject to laws like the CRA I keep mentioning, which really is a fair lending law that was passed in the 70s to require banks to serve all people equitably, irrespective of what community they live in. So, you've got the non-bank lenders like Ameriquest. Probably a lot of people out there know Ameriquest and Countrywide and some of these other really large mortgage companies. And it's really only banks that take deposits in that are subject to law that requires, you ready for this, people to be served equitably. So the notion, and
that's,
we're hearing,
American.
I know, it's very, very.
I remember I think some of your colleagues on years ago talking about how some very high-end names in Wall Street were buying up a lot of these mortgage pushers, right? And this is even though they were, you said they're affiliates, but they're affiliates of some of the biggest names in the financial world, weren't they?
Well, yeah, I'm sort of parsing out sort of what's responsible for what and just kind of quickly trying to debunk some of this mythology out there and this disingenuous claim that somehow, you know, laws to promote homeownership and, you know, banks were pushed into making bad loans is just ridiculous because, again, these were sort of the non-bank mortgage lenders making the loans predominantly, and then bank affiliates not even subject to these laws. that require banks to serve all communities equitably. So, you know, well.
All right. I'm speaking with Sarah Ludwig, who is the director of NEDAP, Neighborhood Economic Development
Advocacy
Project. Sorry, I've got a mental block on that. So what is the scope of the situation now? How many people in New York are facing foreclosure crises? And you know, give us some ideas of
where
how many
now?
And where.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a pretty picture. Right now, it's expected that in this year, projecting for the entire 2008, that more than 15,000 homeowners are going to get served with foreclosure notices in the city. So, okay, there's 8 million people living here. You hear 15,000 foreclosure notices. But imagine this. 2004, 2005, we were already talking about a foreclosure crisis. We were saying there's just a real problem going on in particular neighborhoods. There were about less than 7,000 foreclosure actions filed in those years. So we've had a more than doubling. By some estimates, we're maybe a third to halfway through this crisis. We're not even at the midway point for this crisis, given what we know about many of the products that were sold in recent years that are going to reset, interest-only mortgages, payment option arms, all these sort of products that are out there that are exploding as we speak. You also have people going into default in New York much, much faster than they used to. The people who are going into foreclosure, 70% of them are going into foreclosure within the first 2 years after getting the mortgage. So it tells you that the lion's share of loans were probably not affordable at the outset. And that's kind of a hallmark of all this abusive lending, is that these are loans made to people that were not affordable at the outset, or very soon down the line, people tripped over the wire when their loan reset, or when they, you know, realized they weren't actually paying off their loan. They were paying maybe some of the interest only, and in fact, their loans were getting larger, the amounts, which is a really big problem here in New York. So,
and these numbers are creeping higher as the unemployment rate was pretty low, and now that the unemployment rate is rising, the numbers are really going to rise even more dramatically, aren't they?
Right. I mean, I'm afraid these are probably conservative estimates. And then if you look again at what neighborhoods these are concentrated, these foreclosures, I have a list here, and I, you know, have a map. People can't see it, but again, you can check out our website and look at it there. But the neighborhoods are Flatbush, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Rochdale and Queens, East New York, Jamaica, Canarsie, South Ozone Park, St. Albans, Bushwick, Queens Village. You just go down the list. And these are neighborhoods that have the highest numbers of foreclosure actions or foreclosure filings in the city in sort of reverse order. So we are definitely talking about, African-American Latino neighborhoods, and we're starting to see, this is what I was going to say before, but I lost my train of thought, that a lot of immigrants and newer immigrants have been really targeted for some of the worst loan products that we've seen at all. So you have all these undocumented New Yorkers. We've seen some really, really bad loans coming out of Staten Island, out of the North Shore of Staten Island, where you've got people who got sold mortgages when the broker and the mortgage lender pretty much knew they had these people over the barrel, the borrowers over the barrel, because they wouldn't, you know, speak out or contest the terms or so forth. So now there are a lot of undocumented people also facing foreclosure.
And how is, before I get to this question, we should point out that this is a tragedy for people who are families and people who are losing their houses, but it also is a very dramatic negative influence in the neighborhoods where this is happening in large numbers, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the toxic salad metaphor we were hearing before, is that, or the toxic waste, is that it's not uniformly spread out around, you know, the world or around this country. You've got neighborhoods where there are 5 and 10 foreclosure actions on a single block. You've got the fabric of neighborhoods being ripped apart through this. I do have a little bit of good news I can share, which is that New York State did pass a law that was signed by Governor Patterson in August that makes sure that people who are in foreclosure with subprime loans, or what we call non-traditional or exotic mortgages, as New York defines them, actually now have a right to a settlement conference before a judge, so that at least there's now a fairer shake in court. So if anybody listening out there is, you know, in foreclosure with a subprime or non-traditional loan, or you know somebody who is, you know, they first of all have a right to, in fact it's mandated, right? So they that a judge or a personnel from the court will sit with them and the mortgage servicer and try to achieve some kind of settlement that is in the interest of the borrower rather than what had been happening, which is that really the foreclosure proceedings in New York courts have been pretty much stacked against the borrowers, and many borrowers, most borrowers, didn't even, unfortunately, answer the foreclosure summons. So you had a situation where most foreclosure actions that actually went to auction, where you know the whole proceeding went through, which takes about a year, year and a half in New York, people were losing their homes in default. They weren't answering the summons, and they were automatically losing the proceeding. The other thing is that now in New York, with this new law that just passed, it's called the Foreclosure Prevention and Responsible Lending Act of 2008, you are a servicer or a lender can't file a proceeding in foreclosure in New York courts until they've served the borrower with a pre-foreclosure notice. And they have to do that 90 days before they can go to court. So you get a, you know, you can't even bring a foreclosure action until you've notified the homeowner, you know, you're going to do it. And they've got 90 days in which they can try to get some assistance, reach out to a foreclosure prevention counselor, legal services person, and try to work something out before the foreclosure action is filed, which makes things much more complicated, more expensive for the homeowner, and so forth. The other thing is, it's not just to help people get a fair shake in the process, but New York State has passed, as part of that law, some very important sound lending principles for going forward. I mean, this is one of the things that's just staggeringly, you know, just off the charts about this bailout, is that it doesn't include anything about responsible lending, sound underwriting, accountability of the securities market, credit rating agencies. None of that is even contemplated, and we certainly weren't hearing about it. You know, it would have been one thing if they had said, look, we're going to deal with this, you know, kind of credit crisis right now, the frozen credit markets, but we are going to get to the homeowners next, and we didn't hear any of that, really.
We've only got about 45 seconds left, but is this like or unlike the picture in the rest of the country?
The sort of civil rights implications of the economic justice piece?
Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah, no, it's definitely the patterns we see in New York are the same all around the country. This is definitely an economic justice, civil rights issue of great magnitude.
And I presume the pattern is playing out similarly, like there are neighborhoods that are particularly afflicted with this, and it's going to – are we going to get back to, like, the South Bronx of the 1970s?
Well, you know, New York's a little anomalous. If you think about Buffalo or Detroit or, you know, parts of the country like Cleveland where the property values are pretty much decimated and don't exist – you've got real abandonment and blight. In New York, even with what some people think of as a dip in the real estate market, you still have a lot of value and equity in these homes. So it's not expected we're going to see anything close to the abandonment and blight here as long as there remains this kind of, you know, real estate frenzy that we've had.
Well, we shall see. All right, I've got to bring it to a close there. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with a little bit more of David Byrne and Brian Eno.